There was once a man, and he was very happy because he got a contract that was going to turn his life around. And he was going to bring a lot of money into his family, and everything was going to be good. Before he could get to tell his wife about the new contract, he put it down on the dining room table. And his young son found it, started playing with it, made an airplane out of it. And next thing the parents knew, the son was crying. The husband hadn't yet had a chance to tell the wife about the new contract, the new money, and they were concerned, what was the son crying about? So they went to see, and they saw that his airplane had gone into the fireplace. So he was crying because his toy got broken. He was crying on his own level. He didn't realize what it really represented. The father was upset because the contract got burned. And the mother was just empathizing with the father and was upset about the sad situation. In some way, we can all relate that on a day like today, when we're all supposed to be mourning, there are those that mourn directly, like the father that understands that something that was precious to him was mistreated and was destroyed. Then there's the son who misconstrues what it was that he lost. He knows something was lost, but he doesn't quite know what it was. And then there's most of us who cry because we empathize with the generations of Jews that have cried before us. We know that it's a time of mourning. It's a time like every moed that we have, there's a mood in the air. Pesach time, it's freedom. Every time there's something else in the air, Shavuos, it's Torah. So Tisha B'Av, we feel mourning in the ether, in the air. We're not always quite sure what it is we're mourning, but we mourn. So maybe we'll just spend a little time trying to focus on what it is that we're mourning about. So the simple answer, what we're mourning about, is the Korban and the loss of the Beit HaMikdash, and the yearning for the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, and the yearning for Mashiach. So of course there are people who every night, in the middle of the night, they cry and they say, Tikkun Chatzot for the Beit HaMikdash. Once there was a man, a rabbi, who was staying hundreds of years ago. He was staying, traveling, and he stayed with a farmer and his wife. In the middle of the night, they heard him crying, and they put him up in an old empty barn. And the wife sent the husband to find out what he was crying about. And he explained he was crying about the Beit HaMikdash. He was crying for Mashiach to come. And even though they were religious people, they were very simple. And the farmer and his wife had never heard about Mashiach. They didn't understand what it was. And the wife sent the husband back and forth several times to ask for more and more details. What was this all about? Finally, he explained that it would involve going to Israel, would involve a new beginning, a new life. And the wife, very as politely as possible, sent back word with her husband farmer to the rabbi, could you please stop davening? I don't think we really want this Mashiach of yours to come. So we all say that we're mourning, we say we want things to change, but we have to really think to what degree we understand and to what degree we're mourning. Also, there's a word that is very difficult to try to not use in general, and specifically to not use on this night and this day, and that's the word I. The word I, the letter I, is something that we think about and use naturally all the time. To have a healthy ego is normal, appropriate. And yet today, I think the I is supposed to be replaced with the we. There's not supposed to be much of an I. Maybe tomorrow, as Rabbi Blau spoke about, after Chatzot, we get more into a different mood. It's more tshuva. It's more personal. We can think more about ourselves and our own lives. If you watch the different videos, they're very much, very often, tshuva-related, musa-related. We work on ourselves. But especially tonight as we begin, we obliterate the I and we work on the we. We work on mourning as a nation. There's an approach in psychology called the family systems approach. And one of their sayings is there's no such thing as individuals. There are only fragments of families. There's no such thing as an individual. Every person can only really be understood as a piece of the family they come from. On a similar level as Jews, I think we believe there's no such thing really as an individual Jew, even though in certain contexts and certain levels we do give credence to the individual. But really, in reality, and specifically on communal days, and specifically on Tisha B'Av, there's no such thing as an individual. We're all just fragments. And we're fragments of the one individual unit of being a nation that we're really meant to be. And it's to a large extent the dissolvement of that cohesiveness and the lack of awareness even that we're not supposed to be eyes as much as we's that we think about tonight. Rabbi Avraham Chaim Feuer makes several points and he develops a very beautiful idea about tears. Tisha B'Av is a day where people that are zocha, people that really merit to reach the level, cry. It's a very hard thing to cry. And one of the reasons crying is hard is because crying is something very profound and very deep. There is a story that Yirmiyahu was crying. And he was seen crying, the story goes, by Plato. And Plato said to him, "Why are you crying?" It was right after the Churban. He said, "Why are you crying?" And he explained to him and he said, "I have two questions. Question one is this is just sticks and stones. It's just a building. Who cries over a broken down building? Why are you crying over wood and rock? And the second question is, what's done is done. No use crying over spilled milk. No use crying over something broken. Move on to the future. What use is there? You're a very bright person. What use is there for a bright person, number one, to cry because his house, his temple was broken? And two, why would an intelligent person dwell on the past and be stuck?" So Yirmiyahu answered, and his first answer was, he kind of gave a dare to Plato. He said, "Even though you're a wise man, do you have any questions in your life?" And he said, "Yes, there are things that perplex me." So he said, "Tell me what they are." And Plato went through his litany of questions, and Yirmiyahu answered every single paradox and every problem that Plato had. And Plato was amazed. And he said, "I don't understand. How can anyone be so wise?" And Yirmiyahu said, "I'm wise. I'm wise because of that building that you said you didn't understand why I was mourning. It's difficult to explain, but through the sanctity of that building, I've gained an awareness of God, and I've gained wisdom, and it's through that building that you fail to understand why I'm mourning about it. It's not just sticks and stones. It's a conduit to the wisdom of God, and that's what made me so wise." And then he said he couldn't answer the second question. He said, "There is an answer, but you wouldn't understand." And the Lev Eliyahu, Rav Eliyahu Lapyan, quotes Rav Simcha Zisl Ziv of Kelm, and he says that the reason why he thought, Yirmiyahu thought Plato wouldn't understand the answer is because it was super rational. It wasn't a typical rational answer. Plato was the king, was the paradigm of rationality, and the answer was an emotional answer. The answer was that the way that an evolved person works emotionally is that when we mourn over the past in the proper way, it builds towards the future. And what looks like past is really just the opposite. And when we dwell and mourn seemingly stuck in the past, looking back at the Churban, we're really building to the binyan of the next Beit HaMikdash, and it's building towards the future. But that's a thin line and difficult concept to understand, and one that Yirmiyahu only hinted to in code. The idea of tears is something that's very profound and goes far back in our history, specifically the tears of this night and of this time. Whenever we try to understand something, we have to go back to its roots. We won't dwell on it, but when we talk about happy times, like when we first got to Eretz Yisrael and we brought Bikurim, so when we brought Bikurim, we had true Hakarat HaTov. We went back to the very beginning of our history, to Yaakov Avinu and Arami Oved Avi, and how he was saved from Lavan. Why? Because when you appreciate something positive, you go back to the very beginning of it. Similarly, when you want to feel the full impact of something negative, you also go back to the very beginning of it. So the very beginning of these tears, the very beginning of this mourning that we're feeling, it goes back to the first Tisha B'Av in history, when the Jews cried over the Meraglim. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said something that's very difficult to understand according to our tradition. He said, "You cried b'chiya shel chinam. You cried for no reason." And it sounds almost petty, God forbid, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I'm going to give you a reason to cry. I'm going to be koveya b'chiyo l'dorot. But the idea is really a profound one. It's that tears aren't just something that we do superficially. But Sam Strafal Hirsch says very poetically, he says that tears are like sweat of the soul. Tears are sweat of the soul. And when we really feel something deeply, we can't control it. Just like physically, if we're hot, if we're exhausted, we sweat. Spiritually, when we really feel something, tears come out. Real tears only come out when the emotion is very profound and very deep inside us. B'nai Yisrael felt in a very deep way that their connection with Eretz Yisrael was done, was over, was severed. HaKadosh Baruch Hu kind of recreated a world. When he took us out of Mitzrayim, many Mefarshim say that the Ten Makot, there was a parallel to the Ten Mamarot of creation, and it was a new creation. And an important part of that new creation was the connection between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, us and Torah, and also between the Jewish people and Eretz Yisrael. When the people cried, when they heard what the Meraglim said, they said the deal is off. They said, we're not connected anymore. We don't have that connection. And it was so deep that they cried. They felt that their souls were severed from the land, from Eretz Yisrael. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, it's going to take a long time. You're going to have those kind of real, deep, sincere, spiritual tears in order to get it back. And as much as it was a punishment, it was also a consequence that the only way to rebuild the connection was through tears, the opposite of the tears that severed the connection by choice, or not so much by choice, but by a visceral reaction. So we had to choose to try to recreate that kind of reaction in the opposite direction to get the geula. The question is asked that you're not supposed to, if someone wants to have Ruach HaKodesh, so you can't really be sad. And the books of Tanakh were written with Ruach HaKodesh, and that means they were written when whoever wrote them was Besimcha. So it's difficult to understand how the Sefer could have been written when Yirmiyahu was Besimcha. Clearly he wasn't Besimcha. So the answer given, it's similar to a question from another context that, again, we won't dwell on, but the question is famously asked how Yaakov Avinu could, it seemed like no time for him when he waited to marry Rachel. So one of the answers is, the question is, if you really loved her, it should have felt like a million years, not like no time. But it felt like such a short amount of time because his perspective was a spiritual perspective, not a physical perspective. If it was personal, if it was just physical and just about him, then he couldn't have waited. But because he had a perspective of building the Jewish people, he was able to be patient, and it was a whole separate judgment. It was a whole separate context. Similarly, for Yirmiyahu, the typical kind of happiness or sadness that we talk about, kind of mood that someone's in, that's the kind of mood that matters when you're writing a book. But the kind of sadness that he has was a communal kind of a sadness. It was bigger than just him. It was for Klal Yisrael. And the kind of even-keeled manner that you need in order to write a book, that he had. But the perspective of a global, of a grander, like kind of a vision and a mourning for the Jewish people, that was appropriate in order to write the book. There's a famous saying, and there are several answers to it, that the gates in Shemayim are closed, but the gates, even though there are different gates, there's gates of Torah, there's gates of Tefillah, but the gates of crying are never locked. And the question is, it doesn't say, the way I phrased it was, I misspoke, it doesn't say that they are never closed, it says they're never locked. So if they're never locked, why are there gates in the first place? There are several answers. One is that sometimes we ask for things that are not appropriate for us to get, or it's not yet time for us to get as much as HaKadosh Baruch would like to give it to us. And the gates, even though they're not locked, the gates need to be closed. Also, sometimes someone could fake it. There are tears. We explain that tears are something very profound, but someone could sometimes cry tears that aren't sincere tears. And the gate is only open for the sincere tears, so the gate needs to be closed. It's like we say in Ashra every day, Karav Hashem l'chol karav l'chol asher yikru be'emeh. Sounds like a contradiction. It says anyone that calls Hashem is close to Hashem, and then it says those that call Him in truth. Because the second part is really clarifying the first. This is also from Rav Hirsch, that the crying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'chol karav, potentially HaKadosh Baruch Hu is close to everyone, but actually only if you call in truth. Potentially all tears can get through, but there has to be some type of a test because it's only the sincere tears. Also, there need to be very strong tears, a torrent of tears, a flood of tears, in order to push the gates open. A lot of times we feel bad, I think. I personally do, that what I started talking about, that we focus more on I than we. We focus more on ourselves and on the Jewish people as a whole. Perhaps we could be melamed zchud on this idea that we do, and we could say that deep down we're all really mourning all the time for the Beit HaMikdash. And even if we think consciously that we're caught up in our own problems are because we live in a state of confusion. We live in a time not of Geula. And really, when we seem to be complaining or kvetching about our own issues, what's really bothering us is the fact that we're in unredeemed times. And what we really are crying about all the time is the fact that we want the Geula. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Kuf Aleph Amud Aleph, says that when Rabbi Gamliel would hear a neighbor of his crying, she was a widow, and when she would cry, he would daven for the Beit HaMikdash, and he would cry as well. So some explain that it wasn't just that her crying reminded him of his crying, but he interpreted her crying. He said that I'm crying for the same thing she's crying about. She's crying for the same thing that I'm crying about. Really, it seems she's crying because she's a widow, but really, every Jew, when they cry, they're crying because the way we experience anything we experience is so much harder because we live in a time of galus. And her personal tears inspired him to communal tears, and the two are really linked. Similarly, there's a story about the Bach that for years he was frustrated and upset that he couldn't get his parish published, and one night he was crying about it in the middle of the night, and he said, what am I doing? It's the middle of the night. If I'm crying, I should be crying about the Beis HaMikdash. And he said Tikkun Hatzot, and when he said Tikkun Hatzot, a voice came out and said, you used to say Tikkun Chatzot and then you got caught up in yourself. Now that you return to feeling the pain of Klal Yisrael, your own tefillot will be answered. Something to think about is, what did they do in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash? And the reason it's interesting to think about is because we've all probably overheard people say, and we maybe thought it ourselves, that we walk through Yerushalayim, it's hard sometimes to say Yerushalayim is destroyed, Yerushalayim is in ruins, because we look around and Yerushalayim doesn't seem to be in ruins. And in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, for sure, there was a Beit HaMikdash. Today, we don't have a Beit HaMikdash. I once heard someone say, a Rav say mistakenly, he said, you have to have a Muna that we won't have a third Korban. But we don't have a Korban, I think, implies a Korban Abayah. We don't have a third Bayah to be Necharav. What we have is incomplete. But in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, was it similar to our situation? It's something to think about. I think from the Rambam, it seems, he seems to imply that they did say kinod, and they did mourn because of the things that they didn't have. There were many things that already were lost in the time of the second Bayit that didn't exist from the first, and because of that loss already, they still mourn the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. Kal v'chomer today, there's no question that our mourning is maybe a little bit tempered, but mostly unmitigated. That we're still mourning the loss of the Beit HaMikdash. An example that could be given for this is someone that everybody's happy for, because this person, Rahmanul Islam, he needed a heart transplant. And when he finally gets a heart transplant, everyone's happy for him. And he's walking around, he's functioning, and he's fine. But he is nervous all the time. He's sad, he's worried, he's unhappy. And people can't understand why. And he explains to them, it's never going to be the same. I don't have my heart. No matter what I do, no matter how healthy I seem, the fact is I don't have my heart. My heart was my heart. What I have inside me now is not quite the same. similarly, we live in a time where there's some level of geula, achalta de geula, and yet the Beit HaMikdash was our heart. We don't have the Beit HaMikdash, we don't have the Sanhedrin, we don't have many of the things that we had that were connected with the Beit HaMikdash, so we'll talk about a little more what it is we miss. But as long as we don't have that center, so it's still a time, for sure, it's a time of mourning. So Yirmiyahu was a very tragic figure. Yirmiyahu spent many years, over 40 years, trying to get the Jewish people to do tshuva. They fought him, they tormented him, they put him in jail. And the king Jehoiakim asked him to write something, to write a nevuah. And he wrote this while he was in jail, to write a nevuah of what was going to happen to the Jewish people. And he wrote Echa. And when Jehoiakim read it, he wasn't very bothered. He read a little and a little more and a little more, and it didn't bother him. This is going to happen to the Jewish people. That's going to happen to the Jewish people. It's fine, it's fine. But then he hit one line where it said, Hayutzareha L'Rosh. And he said, I'm not going to be the Rosh. I'm not going to be the king. I'm going to lose my Malchut. And then he got upset. And he took very drastic measures. He took Hashem's name and he cut it out of any place where it appeared in what Yirmiyahu wrote, which was most of Eicha, except for the third parak, and he burnt it. And sometime after that, the Korban happened. And of course, the way things always go, when the Korban happened, Yirmiyahu empathized with the people. He followed the people into captivity. And they all started crying. And he cried with them also. And going back to what we mentioned before about tears and the depths of tears, he said to the people, if only you would have cried one tear, if you would have cried at all before, when you were still in Eretz Yisrael, then this never would have happened. You never would have been exiled had you cried before. But now, what had to take place already has taken place. The question can be asked, how we move into the mood. It's very difficult, all of a sudden, for me it's difficult, to be sitting on the floor, to be mourning. It's hard. So part of how we try to rectify the problem is for 3 weeks, for 9 days, for 1 week, the week of Tisha B'Av, we try to get into the spirit. I once heard someone say, Rahman al-Islan, if a person ever wants to know how to deal with difficult times, the only answer to how to feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu in different times in your life is to work on feeling HaKadosh Baruch Hu in your life the rest of the time in your life. When things are good, when things are normal, when things are quote-unquote natural, if a person works on seeing, smelling, touching, tasting, feeling the world in a way that they are close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then when things are difficult, they're going to flow into it naturally. Similarly, if missing the Beit HaMikdash, the way the Shulchan Aruch starts the very beginning and mentions there are things we're supposed to do always to remember the loss of the Beit HaMikdash. If we do that all the time, then on this day, it's amplified. But if we just jump into it out of the blue, it's very difficult. There's a Hasidic tradition that there are four types of galus. There's galus, of course, from Eretz Yisrael. There's galus from Hashem. There's galus from each other. And there's galus from ourselves. Sometimes we wonder, what does it mean to be in galus? Someone I know once said, galus is wanting to do the right thing, but not knowing what it is. It's a lack of clarity. The Ramban says that when it says in the Torah that a time will come, when Mashiach comes, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will circumcise our hearts, it means that there's a cloudiness around our hearts. There's a fuzziness. We all want to do the right thing. We don't know. We don't know what the right thing is. We want to do it, but we don't see it. When Mashiach comes, it's not that we won't have Bechira anymore, but we'll see what the right thing is that we want to do anyway. We'll see it more clearly. When we see it clearly, it'll be easier to do. That fuzziness, that lack of clarity will be removed. And that's what I think the essence of having the Beit HaMikdash was about. It was a clarity. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot lists something that at first glance it could seem trivial, just to memorize that there were 10 miracles that happened when we had the Beit HaMikdash. But if you think about it, all those 10 miracles, what they did were, they gave us clarity of the existence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the involvement of Hashem in our lives. The fact that we had those consistent miracles, the fact that we checked in regularly and saw and felt those miracles means that we felt God in our lives. And that's what we mourn. We mourn that lack of clarity. We mourn that lack of knowing and seeing clearly that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in our lives. There's a story told that someone was teaching Ethiopian children in Israel, and when she got to Pesach, she started talking about Aliyah L'Regel. And the kids were very interested. They said, well, what's it like when you go on Aliyah L'Regel? And she was taken back by the question. And they kept having this miscommunication. They kept asking her what her trip to the Beit HaMikdash was like, what it was like to be there, what it looked like, what it felt like. And she didn't understand. And finally she tried to say as bluntly as she could, I don't understand why you're talking the way you are, being that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. The next day there was a turnout in school of many parents that came and they were upset. They said, why did you tell our children that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed? Because they didn't know. They didn't have the Masorah. They came to Eretz Yisrael expecting the grand times, expecting that it hadn't stopped. And when they heard that it had stopped, it was so real for them. They recognized the loss. They were counting on that connection. And at least one time a year, we're supposed to kind of feel that loss the same way that they did. The question is asked sometimes why we don't speak explicitly in any of the keynote. We don't mention Mashiach ben David. We don't mention the word Mashiach, the concept of Mashiach. Perhaps the answer is in the name Mashiach ben David. There's a famous idea that David HaMelech wrote more than once, things that were very sad. But the thing about David was, whenever he wrote things, even though they were sad, he always had hope. He wrote Mizmor L'Asaf Elokim Ba'u Goyim B'Nachalatecha. He wrote a Mizmor saying that Goyim came into the Beit HaMikdash, the Goyim destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, and yet it was called the Mizmor. So Chazal asked, why isn't it called the Kina? And the famous answer is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took out his anger on Eitzim and Avanim, and not on human beings, so it's a reason to be happy. Similarly, on a personal level, David wrote a Mizmor when his son was chasing him to kill him. And they say it was a Mizmor because it could have been someone else. The fact that it was his son, there was some compassion. These are uniquely positive ways, positive angles of seeing things. And it's a bit much for today to have so much hope, to have such a positive outlook that every kina becomes a Mizmor. That's the outlook of David HaMelech, and that's why we hold back on the reference to Mashiach ben David on this day. One of the things that we'll be doing in the over 40 keynote that we say tomorrow is we'll be going through the Aleph Beit over and over and over again. So I heard something that makes sense in the name of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I hope it's not wrong of me. I have another approach to it that's different than Rav Soloveitchik's. Rav Soloveitchik said that Yirmiyahu and that the other people that wrote the keynote, they had so much emotion that it was endless. And what they wrote for us and what they cried for themselves would have gone on forever if they didn't contain it in some way. So the way they contained it was by writing out the letters of the Aleph Beis. So I think, and I've written some poems on my own, I think that sometimes, even if you're someone that's setting out to write a poem, you're a poet, you don't know where to start, you don't know what to say. But if you say, I'll use the initials of my name, I'll use the letters of the alphabet, then you have a way to express, and it can inspire you creatively. You look at some of the keynote, and they're very challenging. For example, if you look at keynote Zion that Rabbi Elazar Kalier wrote, and it's for every odd letter of the Aleph Beis, starting with Aleph, he says Eicha, and then he uses five words starting with that letter. And then for every even letter starting with Beis, he does six with that letter. So it seems like he was stretching himself and pushing himself. It's not that he had hundreds of letters. You look at something like the letter Vav, where most of us would just think of the something, and he comes up with six words that start with Vav that are actual words. it's not that he had so many and was narrowing it down. It's more, I think, that he was expanding himself. And one of the ideas of the keynote, I think, and again, it's different after Chatzot tomorrow, can become more personal, but I think it's appropriate for everyone to sit. And I think the Paitanim didn't just want us to recite what they said, but to try to sit and write using the letters of our name, using the letters of the Aleph Beis, using the letters Geula or Mashiach or Galut or whatever we want, to write something from ourselves, of ourselves, and feel something on this day. God willing, next Shabbos we'll say Nachamu, Nachamu. The question is asked, why does it say Nachamu twice? So, some say a very beautiful idea that sometimes when you're so broken and you get consolation, you resist it at first. We've all seen this with children and with adults too. People don't change that much. Someone is crying and someone wants us to console them, so we go and we console them, we hug them, and what do? They break away, they run away. And we say, oh, forget it. But what they really want is they want us to continue to console them. It's Nachma Nachma because we're so broken we need consolation more than once. But there's another way of looking at it as well, and that's that Nachamu Nachamu, you have to add one word in between. Nachamu, because Nachamu. The fact that we still need Nachama is itself a source of Nachama. There's a famous story that most people, I think, know, but I always think of it and repeat it on this day, is that Napoleon heard people crying for the Beis HaMikdash. He didn't know anything about this. He said, what temple? Where temple? And they told him it had happened years before. And he said, if you're still crying over something you lost so long ago, for sure you'll merit to see it rebuilt. The fact that we can't let it go, like Yaakov for Yosef, the fact that we feel the mourning so strongly means it's alive for us and means that potential will come to actuality. And that's a nechama in and of itself. Another theme of the day, and we're going to finish soon. Another theme of the day is Achdus. One of the things that brings us Nechama, and perhaps the only real secret to Nechama, is uniting together. We all know that Sinat Chinam brought about the destruction, and there's a stira, a contradiction, that elsewhere in the Gemara it says it wasn't Sinat Chinam, it was the fact that people didn't give each other Tochacha. And at first glance, if someone didn't think deeply, they might think, if someone tells someone else off, that's not loving someone else. But the idea is that when you really love someone, you tell them what they need. There's a story that a Hasidic Rebbe said, I learned what love is from two drunks on a park bench. One of them said to the other, do you love me? And the first said, yes. And the other said, then what do I need? And the other said, I don't know. And he said, if you don't know what I need, then you don't really love me. When you really care about someone, you give them tochacha in an appropriate way. That explains a question that's often asked also, why when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, they found the Kerubim facing each other, which is a sign of Ahava. So it could be that everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu does for us is really from Ahava. It could be the fact that he took it out on Eitzim Ba'avanim is really Ahava. But it could also be that what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us, and this I heard from Rabbi Spiro, is that the idea is he's telling us to face each other. He's telling us the only way we're going to get out of this situation of Galus is to face each other, to embrace each other. There's also the concept that the real day of mourning was the 10th of Av. However, we mourn on the 9th of Av because Adchalta de Puranuta Adifa. So there are technical ways of looking at this. Rav Soloveitchik and others say that the Kedusha was really lost at the beginning. So technically that's when the terrible things happen, once the Kedusha was lost. But also, I think it's a deep Musar idea in life that the beginning of tragedy is a tragedy. That's why, besides today, we have Shivas HaBetamas. Besides Shivas HaBetamas, we have Asara Beteve, which is a very strange day. The siege around the city seems to be kind of benign compared to what we're thinking of today. But on Asara B'Teve, and also today, when we think about the 9th as opposed to the 10th, we remember that the beginning of a tragedy, just like we said before, whenever you want to fully appreciate something positive or negative, you look back to the very beginning of it, the beginning of a tragedy is also a tragedy. So, just to review quickly, the idea is that today is supposed to be a we day, not an I day, that we're supposed to cry tears that should be real tears. we're supposed to feel this all the time and bring it out really on Tisha B'Av, that we should go through the Aleph Beis, we should go through it ourselves and write our own keynote, that we should feel nechama from the fact that we need nechama, that we should have achdus with each other, and we should work on these ideas, think of these ideas, and be zocheh to see the Beit HaMikdash very soon.